We've been following the tidal wave of events which inundated Cambodia in 1970. The coup, Lon Nol's struggle to create a new government, pogroms against the Vietnamese civilians, and Nixon's decision to conduct a massive military operation in order to eradicate the long-standing Viet Cong and North Vietnamese sanctuaries in Cambodia, looking to disrupt those 50,000 or more communist troops in the country. All of these events we've been covering have been on the American, South Vietnamese, and new Cambodian government's side. But now we need to turn our attention to the other side. In this same frantic few months after Sihanouk had been removed from power, joining in a coalition with his former adversaries, the Khmer Rouge, as well as the Chinese and the North Vietnamese. There was a date quite early on in this chaos that I glossed over amongst the aftermath of the coup, the massacres, the riots, and massive military gains of the Vietnamese communists in those early days of April 1970. Because it was on the 3rd of April, in an attempt by the new Lon Nol regime to show a distinct sign of change to the Sihanouk era that they had ended, an announcement was made, an order, that several hundred political prisoners jailed over the last few years would be released. This prisoner release was an attempt to build up some good faith, showing that even their enemies, that there was some progression here. Perhaps it was also figured that this new government needed to soften any animosity that might be coming their way, even from their political enemies. Perhaps it was done within the same planning that included targeting the civilian Vietnamese population as a means of redrawing the lines of who they thought the threat was. That it had been Lon Nol's security forces that had put these people in jail in the first place and then subjected them to incredibly harsh conditions in overcrowded cells, using torture and even extrajudicial killings. Well, to be fair, this was under the overall direction of Sihanouk, who was more than happy to utilize these aspects of his formerly trusted right-hand man, as and when they suited Sihanouk's own administration of the country. But those subjected to the cudgel of Cambodia's police had ranged from just engaging in peaceful protest, but there were many of those who were arrested that were actively engaged, card-carrying members of the Communist Party of Kampuchea. Some of those that were released by this order were sufficiently impressed by the idea of a new administration emerging and caught up in a wave of euphoria and optimism that many of the urbanites of Phnom Penh had felt when Sihanouk was deposed. They decided to remain in the capital and try and encourage the government to make reforms that they had wanted to achieve through political means over the last decade. They were going to give it a shot. However, the majority of the prisoners released quietly went back to their homes, back to the provinces. One of those who returned to the countryside had been arrested and imprisoned without trial since the beginning of 1968. He later recalled seeing people executed inside the bleak walls of Prey Sar, which is still Cambodia's largest prison. The infamously cramped and unsanitary conditions haven't gotten much better from what I can tell. But this man walked out on the morning of the 3rd of April, 1970. By nightfall, he'd made it back to his home village in Stuong province, about 120 miles north of Phnom Penh. In the year before he had been arrested, he had been distributing books and pamphlets for his local network of the Khmer Rouge. He'd been asked to pick a new revolutionary name once he had committed himself to the revolution. His given name, Khang Gek Iv, carried a Cambodian Chinese heritage. Knowing this was a Cambodian revolutionary party, he adopted a Khmer name instead. He recalled from his childhood a local sculptor revered by his grandfather, and he also remembered an illustration from a textbook when he was at school. It depicted a disciplined, earnest child, respectful toward teachers, eager to do good deeds. Strangely enough, both the sculptor and the child in that picture shared the same name, which had left a lasting impression on Khang Gek Iv. He decided to call himself Doik. That name, you might know, my dear listener, lives in infamy for its connection to S21, Tuol Sleng, the central node of the Khmer Rouge prison and torture facility network. Doik was the commandant of this prison, if you could even call it that. Prison conveys a sense of people having done something wrong, being sent somewhere for punishment or rehabilitation. But what was constructed out of the classrooms of a high school in the southern section of Phnom Penh didn't have these kinds of rehabilitative concerns. You were guilty if you were sent there. You produced proof of your guilt and associates via confessions made to your young guards, interrogators, and torturers. Then, you were taken away and killed. This is a place that if you're listening to this podcast, you've heard me talk about, you've probably heard about it before, I'm sure many of you have visited this place, or perhaps will one day. More than 12,000 people were sent through its gates between 1975 and 1979, and it is well known that only a handful of those lived to tell about their experience. But S21 didn't come from nothing, nor did Doik. While he himself had waited in prison, in terrible conditions, but not, I assure you, nothing as bad as what he would later oversee, his family had been able to visit, provide him extra food. They had even made inroads in organising his potential release much earlier, via a distant relationship to one of Lon Nol's nephews. The formerly gifted math student, who had attended Cambodia's prestigious schools before falling into the sway of the communists, had only needed to sign a letter of apology. But Doik refused. He believed Lon Nol would be defeated, that the Khmer Rouge armies were growing. If he took that deal, how could the revolution trust him? And if he turned around and stayed with Lon Nol, how could they trust a former opponent, a former prisoner? So he stayed loyal to the communist cause, fully prepared to sacrifice his life. It turned out to be the right decision, if we could call it that, ensuring Aung Kyaw never questioned his loyalty, and he hadn't defected to the side that ultimately lost the Cambodian Civil War. He must have been surprised at being let out so early, but he was not about to repay this reprieve back to those that had jailed him. Doik was committed. He was a believer in the revolution. Doik spent 3 weeks with his loved ones upon release, just as the events of April that we covered blew up and out of control. The Vietnam War bled deep into Cambodian territory as the North Vietnamese and Viet Cong battalions scrambled inland as they sought to secure as much territory as possible before they were forced to brace themselves for Nixon's incursion that was announced at the end of the month. It was under these extreme circumstances that Doik headed back to Phnom Penh to continue his work for the Khmer Rouge. He returned to a place that he had known well since the early 60s, Wat Unalom, a Buddhist monastery. Built in the 15th century and noticeable for its rose-coloured walls by the waterfront near Sisawat Key, you might even recall that it had been hit in the accidental US bombing of Phnom Penh during the Second World War, the fatal and shocking event that had led a young monk named Thu Samut to flee to the border, joining the Vietnamese communists, eventually becoming one of the first leaders of the Cambodian communist movement. But that was 25 years ago. Now, Doik, in the day, carried out what he called his revolutionary activities, and at night, he stayed in the monastery. He had known the head monk very well, thought of him as a father figure, one that had threatened to throttle him once he found out about his political activities. But they'd remained close. But despite Doik's deep connection to Buddhism, his communist ideology was more prominent in his mind. He attempted to entice monks to join the revolution, and told friends that religion was a blood-sucking leech. By August of 1970, Doik was permitted to join the revolutionaries in the Koh Tom area of Kandal province, roughly 30 miles south, one of many zones slipping out of government control in the aftermath of the coup. For months, the Vietnamese communists had taken control of huge areas of territory. Recall that crescent moon shape descending from the east. Millions of Cambodians were now being affected and either beginning to flee toward the cities that the Lon Nol regime still maintained, or learning what life was going to be like under this new wartime administration. What that was like, we shall see. These massive territorial gains, practically overnight, strengthened further by a strategy to avoid large-scale confrontations with the Americans and South Vietnamese once the incursion began, gave the Vietnamese communists confidence. They concluded that the Cambodian Revolution had made a great leap forward and positioned at least 70,000 of their own troops in the country. They aimed to raise a similar number of Cambodian Khmer Rouge troops, effectively merging South Vietnam and Cambodia into one sprawling battlefield. However, they also decided that their leadership role would be crucial. They believed the Khmer Rouge weren't yet organized enough to handle things on their own. The Lon Nol government was in no position to fight this war, hence their own pleading to the world for assistance, even if it had to begrudgingly come from the South Vietnamese, or as we saw, in whatever the US would muster to relieve the pressure on an almost imminent collapse. That placed the Khmer Rouge, whose numbers and territory were now expanding as well, but still small and inexperienced, in a tricky position. They had to administer these newly liberated areas. This wasn't the remote, isolated terrain of Ratanakiri, with a few scattered jungle camps. Now they oversaw territory filled with regular Cambodian citizens. Taking on the monopoly on violence, the power of the state to enforce laws through force, meant identifying and dealing with enemies, maintaining internal discipline, and above all, figuring out how to coexist, or not, with their Vietnamese comrades. Complicating matters further were the more than 1,500 Cambodians who had been living in Hanoi since the end of the war with the French, the Khmer Viet Minh, trained and ready to join the revolutionary struggle. The equivalent of the Vietnamese bringing with them their own contractors to work in the business, who they would attempt to place into administrative and management roles. For the Communist Party of Kampuchea, they felt the need to embrace this new set of circumstances, what they had been patiently waiting for since Pol Pot had fled to the jungles way back at the start of 1963. But they also knew they needed to be cautious. They were like a spider inching out from its web, paranoid about their own survival and prepared to cut down anyone perceived as a threat. It was in response to these unstable new wartime circumstances that Doik was told to move from Kandao province to the Khmer Rouge stronghold in the southwest zone, under the leadership of Ta Mok, a man who would later become one of the most feared Khmer Rouge commanders. Mok had a background intertwined with the Buddhist order as well. He spent time as a monk in his late teens before joining the Issarak freedom fighters. Much like Pol Pot, he rose quickly through the Khmer Rouge ranks. By the time of the coup, he was well established as the authority in the southwest, long an area resistant to government control. We last saw him struggling to keep the armed struggle alive following the declaration of war by Pol Pot and the Standing Committee at the start of 1968, around the same time Doik had been arrested. Doik was summoned to Am Liang in the southwest. It's about 60 miles west of Phnom Penh, a beautiful part of the country. Initially, his role was similar to a kind of policing function, rooting out enemies and enforcing party rules. But in July 1971, he was tasked with commanding a new prison, a security centre in the Khmer Rouge's stronghold, dedicated to interrogating suspected spies or enemies of the Khmer Rouge. They called it M13, which if I look at some very old notes I made during some translating work that I was not at all qualified to do, I wrote down somewhere that this relates to the Khmer word munti, meaning office or camp, so Office 13. And there, on a rather innocuous bend in a river just east of Tamar Kop village, in a clearing of sparse trees, the blueprint for S21 emerged. But instead of classrooms cleared of their chairs and tables, or makeshift brick divisions built into cramped cells within their walls, the imprisonment at M13 was much more rustic. Wooden shacks on the ground, or indeed trenches dug into the earth, would suffice as the prison's walls and cells. Over the next 4 years, while civil war raged and Khmer Rouge forces extended their reach, more and more spies and traitors were flushed out in the so-called liberated zones. Crude torture by teenage recruits and systematic executions became standard practice. Doik and his cadres refined the techniques that would later define S21 after the final victory in 1975. And just like M13 acted as the precursor for what the Khmer Rouge went on to create in the classrooms of Tuol Sleng High School, so too did many other circumstances of their later rule take form in these early years of the Civil War. their paranoia, their obsession with finding spies, their distrust of the Vietnamese communists and anyone associated with them, as well as perhaps one of the most defining features of what we now call the Khmer Rouge regime, their willingness to kill anyone who deviated from their political line, not just imprison, not just re-educate, the chilling phrase employed by numerous socialist regimes in the 20th century before them, but to simply smash, to literally obliterate their perceived enemies. This impulse, this instinct, was on full display as early as 1971, 4 years before the collapse of the Lon Nol regime, years before the US carpet bombing would render huge areas of Cambodia as if it was the surface of the moon. So how did that happen? What mixture of circumstances brought this together? And how does Pol Pot lean into this new exponential growth of the revolutionary movement in Cambodia? How do they begin fighting this war? We are going to look at a foundational period for the Communist Party of Kampuchea, where in just over that year, from Doik getting released from jail and then heading up M13, where Pol Pot will find a new base in the middle of the country, far from the mountains they had been confined to, and see the number of Cambodians under their control rise into the millions. Okay, everyone, welcome back. Good to be here with you. As you can tell, in this episode, we're going to shift perspectives and cover these next few months from the Cambodian communist side. In other words, we'll look at the same April, May, June 1970 stretch we covered from Lon Nol's viewpoint, plus the American decision to sort of clear those sanctuaries. But now we'll see how the Khmer Rouge handled these upended circumstances, pushing onward to about mid-1971. I've brought us into this story through Doik's release from prison, bookending it with him being entrusted to head up M13. That arc spans from April 1970 to July 1971, but I realise we haven't fully caught up with Salot Sar, who was in Beijing when Sihanouk arrived, quietly working in the background to organise the National Front that was officially going to challenge Lon Nol. That's the National United Front of Kampuchea, FUNK, which aimed to set up a Royal Government of National Union of Kampuchea, GRUNK. Yes, the acronyms are back and they're full on until about 1998. So don't worry too much, we'll take it slow on that front. So let's start there, back in April, and follow Salot Sar as he begins the long journey home to Cambodia during an incredibly turbulent time. The main thing to keep in mind, our big piece of context from the last two episodes, is that almost immediately after the coup was declared, and once Sihanouk publicly appealed for Cambodians to join the resistance, the Vietnamese communist armies began expanding westward. The Lon Nol forces quickly retreated in the face of a more powerful enemy, setting up a scenario that was crucial not just for the Vietnamese, but for the Khmer Rouge as well. So, at the beginning of April, Salot Sar leaves Beijing, having organised the role of his Communist Party of Kampuchea, CPK, in the new coalition with Sihanouk. But keeping his leadership secret from him, who believes that the so-called three ghosts, the former leftist politicians in his government, Khieu Samphan, Hun Nim, Hu Yuan, were in charge of the movement. These guys were the kind of archetypal Khmer Rouges that Sihanouk had in mind when coming up with the phrase in the first place. Though, in fact, they were merely a screen to keep the real core leadership hidden, and were actually still held with a degree of suspicion by Salot Sar, Nuon Chea, Son Sen, Vaughn Vet, Sao Pim, and Tha Mok, the so-called Standing Committee, the highest-ranking members of the party. So by the start of April, Sar leaves Beijing for Hanoi, where he had been prior to the events of the coup. Remember, he had gone there to request weapons from the North Vietnamese because his armed struggle, declared at the beginning of 1968, as I mentioned earlier, was really struggling. By the beginning of 1970, they were seriously, you know, apart from a few enclaves across the country, really, you know, not doing too well. the revolution waged with empty hands, as he had put it. Lê Duẩn had refused this military support in no uncertain terms. No weapons, no direct support. The leader of the Vietnamese Workers' Party had actually wanted the fighting toned down completely so it wouldn't interfere with and complicate their own objectives in South Vietnam, where, as we know, Sihanouk was a big part of keeping that fragile balance in line. These conversations and the subsequent discussions, once he was back in Hanoi, were recorded from Sa's perspective in his 1978 book, Livre Noir, The Black Book, which we've referenced before. It's a very subjective take on Vietnam from a Khmer Rouge perspective. It's steeped in centuries-long grievances and conspiratorial theories, an attempt to call attention to the aggression of Cambodia's eastern neighbor, and written while the Khmer Rouge were at war with the Vietnamese. Essentially, Pol Pot frames the coup as a major setback for the Viet Cong and North Vietnamese. They were suddenly vulnerable to attacks from the rear, reliant on their Cambodian bases, and according to Pol's not entirely reliable figures, they had 80,000 wounded Vietnamese soldiers in hospitals along the border. He recalls a meeting with Lê Duẩn, Pham Van Dong, Vo Nguyen Giap, and other key leaders. Pol claims that this time, they were suddenly pouring out friendly words and warm embraces, what he describes as a complete 180 from before. In his telling, the Vietnamese realized they needed the Khmer Rouge to keep their supply lines and bases in Cambodia viable. Pol's main message is a self-aggrandizing one, a kind of, oh, well, 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 look who needs who now. Quote, before the coup, everything done by the CPK was condemned by the Vietnamese. Now, anything the CPK did was correct and praiseworthy. End quote. He takes it a step further, saying they owed the Khmer Rouge and were terrified the CPK might refuse to help. He reads it as the Vietnamese scheming to dominate Cambodia, already planning to swallow it once they weathered this crisis. Keep in mind that this is being written in 1978 amid a full-blown war with Vietnam, so any statements must be viewed as part truth, part paranoia, and part revisionist history. Still, it's clear that at least an embryonic version of this suspicion was present back in 1970, beneath the polite smiles during these official talks. This is most apparent when Sa wrote, quote, their plan was placing Kampuchea under their domination. The Vietnamese were not only satisfied with the help and assistance of Kampuchea for their survival, but they already thought that, once out of danger, they would swallow Kampuchea. Even at the moment when they had to face their greatest difficulties, they persisted in concocting all kinds of manoeuvres to sate this ambition. End quote. Again, I want to emphasise that this is Pol Pot's reading of events, and if nothing else, he was a liar. But the mindset here that he is describing was pervasive throughout the leadership of his movement. And recall that Sa's wife, Kieu Ponnery, was suffering from a more pronounced outset of schizophrenia, which some sources seem to indicate became even worse during this trip to Hanoi and Beijing. And one wonders exactly which way the influence of these circumstances was affecting her, and perhaps those around her. An outburst over, say, a glass of water that her husband was about to drink, because she had been sure that Vietnamese spies were attempting to murder them. Was this an expression of fears already baked into her psyche? Or a reflection of the psychology that some within the Khmer Rouge had toward their erstwhile comrades. In a section titled, The Vietnamese Maneuvers Toward the Delegation of the CPK on its Passing Through in the Vietnamese Territory, which is, I'm not sure if that translates better in French or Khmer, anyway, meaning how things transpired on their way from Beijing and eventually back to Cambodia via Hanoi, in Pol Pot's book, he claims that the Vietnamese were more concerned about controlling Cambodia than actually liberating South Vietnam. And that's pretty absurd on its face, but there is an angle of looking at that where you see some truth to Vietnam's immediate need to secure a territory inside Cambodia. Losing it would cripple their war effort next door. Similarly, a quick and total victory over the new Lon Nol government by the communist Vietnamese would have made the whole of Cambodia a staging ground for attacks against South Vietnam, as opposed to just a few sanctuaries on the border. This eventuality was one of the concerns that had forced Nixon's hand in actually ordering the incursion by the end of April. So Cambodia was very important to the communist Vietnamese. It's also not surprising that Lê Duẩn offered 5,000 rifles to the CPK in exchange for joint commands, a potential sweetener to ensure Vietnamese oversight of the Khmer forces that they were going to train. From Pol Pot's perspective, this was a red flag. He'd been part of the Khmer Viet Minh in 1953 and witnessed firsthand how the Vietnamese sidelined Cambodian communists. Joint command had merely meant Vietnamese command of Cambodian troops. Now he worried that history was repeating, that the CPK's aims and autonomy would be swallowed up by Vietnam's ambitions. Meanwhile, on the ground in Cambodia, the Vietnamese communists had already made moves to take advantage of the chaos following the coup, and the realization of joint command was being treated as a fait accompli. Within a week of the coup, Nguyen Chea, acting deputy in Pol's absence, had been approached by Vietnamese commanders in the East Zone. They'd offered joint military actions, pushing for immediate cooperation, with the insinuation that they were going to be expanding with or without Khmer Rouge tagging along. Given that the advice that Pol had given Nguyen Chea before he left was, you know, take any possible chances to get more territory as part of their armed struggle that they had been engaged in, he felt forced to accept this, although he apparently tried to keep this limited until Pol had returned. A little bit like being forced into a sale or something, like while your manager is out of the office and you don't really feel confident in making a big decision, but what are you going to do? Nguyen Chea telegrammed Pol in Hanoi explaining what was going on. However, in the Black Book, Pol claims that he was crucially only shown the second page of Nguyen Chea's telegram, the bit saying that the joint commands had been agreed to, which he took as a deliberate attempt to force his hand, like someone having already delivered the item to your house and saying, well, it's been signed off by someone, so you kind of have to pay for it and keep it. Whether this is a reflection of real events or Pol's later spin on what happened is hard to say, but the theme of having figured out the Vietnamese underhanded attempts to trick them is littered throughout his writing and narrative. And it wasn't just Nguyen Chea who was receiving these kinds of offers. Pol also wrote that while he was still in Hanoi, the Vietnamese military commanders were reaching out to other zone leaders, like Yang Sari and Son Sen in the northeast, in Ratanakere, which had been their most secure area until this point. The way he explains this implies that these high-ranking members of the party were approached in a way that implied that Pol had already signed off on these joint commands, even though that wasn't the case. In this case, Pol provides some extra details, saying that this love bomb included an offer of a 200-bed hospital unit, complete with cooks, which he sarcastically references in the Black Book as an indication that, quote, the Vietnamese even wanted to teach us how to cook rice. And I know that there are at least a few cultural barriers for us outsiders to assess here, but I'm sure we can all relate on some level to this kind of thing. A mother-in-law's subtle dig at cooking, or a foreigner explaining they've had a better version of a national dish back home. We get it. And I hope I'm not stepping out of line here, but I can imagine the idea of rice not being prepared well enough being a particular sore point in this cultural context. Now, even though Yang Sari and Son Sen rebuffed these advances, as far as I can tell, the Vietnamese communists basically did what they were going to do. You'll recall, my dear listener, that in the weeks after the coup, the time we're talking about, whole provinces were falling out of reach of the new Cambodian government, across the country, not just in the east. In May, perhaps the most significant addition to these dominoes of territory followed suit. Angkor, the very symbol of Khmer nationalism, fell into the hands of the Coalition to Liberate Cambodia. But of course, what this meant really was that it had been captured by the Vietnamese under the guise of this national front. This was done in the spirit of, hey, our mission is your mission is our mission, to quote the Vietnamese at this time, with the added, not-so-subtle jab, that they were providing clever and effective leadership where it was needed. And one can imagine the shock for the Lon Nol regime and the citizens of Phnom Penh seeing Angkor fall into the hands of the enemy. But it also really rankled with the CPK to see this most holy and important area administered by, you know, the umbrella which represented them. But in reality, the power was held by their more powerful allies. But they, the Vietnamese that is, knew what they were doing. They knew not to present these as victories for themselves, but for the Cambodian revolutionaries. And they achieved this by distancing any notion that they were coming as the dreaded Vietnamese conquerors that most, if not all, Cambodians had a long-standing fear of, not just the Khmer Rouge. So how did they achieve this? Well, Ben Kiernan notes in How Pol Pot Came to Power that thousands of armed propaganda teams roamed the countryside in places that had been vacated militarily by the Lon Nol government. They presented themselves as primarily agents to bring Sihanouk back to power and to fight against US imperialism, which, given Lon Nol's necessary acquisition of help from the Americans, became a very easy picture to paint. They even established new administrative bodies in these areas, following the programs they had established in South Vietnam since the late 1950s, or even further back in the war with the French. Elections were held in areas to appoint new village and sub-district chiefs, I suppose the equivalent of dismissing your local council or town board and appointing locals into these positions. Now, obviously most of the people that might have traditionally put their hands up to volunteer for such a position had already fled to the cities. If you were a local business owner or ran a plantation or something like that, once you heard the Viet Cong were coming, you would have made the very logical decision to pack your bags and head for the city, as did many locals who feared either Vietnamese rule generally or any kind of communist reorganization. Usually, those left over who were looking to fill these positions were, first and foremost, Sihanoukist nationalists, if they weren't already associated with some kind of network of the Khmer Rouge. And once again, we see the impact of having Sihanouk as this mirage, this figurehead of the coalition, where all of this recruitment of this organization, of this winning over of a vast majority of people in the countryside, was not being done in the name of communism at all, but rather via the power that the former king still had over their culture and lives. And when combined with the abject terror that was caused by the widespread bombing that was being handed out by the United States, even though it was not completely over the whole countryside at this point, again, this is a very easy picture to paint in the minds of these locals. Rally to Sihanouk's cause, fight against the Americans, fight against this imposter Lon Nol, who's living in Phnom Penh. Now, I say all of this because this is all before Salot Sar could even get back to Cambodia. The Vietnamese had taken a complete control of this new front in the Vietnam War. I can't stress this enough. In this period, we are really talking about the Vietnam War playing out in Cambodia. And by that I mean it is Viet Cong and North Vietnamese battalions fighting South Vietnamese or Lon Nol troops, or really fighting no one at all and simply taking over large amounts of territory, which in their words would be then transferred over to the local Khmer Rouge at an unspecified date. And you would have thought, from a Khmer Rouge perspective, well, that's all good, right? They've gone from having a few thousand members of the army, a few areas of the country they could be secure in, and only the weapons they'd been able to steal off the government in guerrilla raids over the last couple of years. So this is all huge. Well, from their standpoint, this was both an opportunity and a threat. What if this just ended up like it did after the Geneva Accords 15 years prior, with the Vietnamese going back to Vietnam, content with what they had won in the war, and the Khmer Rouge, still relatively weak, were left to defend themselves against whatever was left in Cambodia? Or worse, what if this actually kept going like it was, and the Lon Nol government fell, but to a resistance that was set up not by the Cambodian communists, but to the administration that was being hastily assembled across the country by the Vietnamese? And what if the Vietnamese didn't leave at all? The most salient example of this fear was the 1,000 to 1,500 Khmer communists who had spent the last 15 years in Hanoi. Could they be trusted? Before they left, Son Ngoc Minh, remember him? The first leader of the Cambodian communists way back in the early 50s, he called a meeting of these cadre before they were sent back to Cambodia. He told them that their exact mission would be given to them by the party in Cambodia, which was an indication that he had accepted Pol Pot's authority by this point. But from the CPK's perspective, how would they really know that? It's pretty clear that since, I think, 1967, when Pol returned from that first Beijing trip, or really even going back to 1960, in one of their earliest party meetings, that there has been a fairly staunch anti-Vietnamese contingent in the upper echelons of the party, and one that had grown in influence since then. I should hasten to say that this didn't stop them from copying the Vietnamese communists in a variety of ways, or kept, you know, relying on them. But there was a concern, particularly for the leaders, that this contingent of returnees might be utilized to usurp them and take control of the movement, to dismantle the networks that they had established over the last 10 years or so, and replace the CPK's administration with ones that are more friendly to Vietnamese interests. However real any of that was is immaterial, because it was what this influential group within the CPK were concerned with. This culminated in the suspicion on behalf of Pol, and what he wrote about in the Black Book, about what he felt were Vietnamese communist attempts to, quote, secretly organize a parallel state power and a secretly organized parallel army in Cambodia. So what does he mean by that? Well, the state power, that's kind of what we've been talking about, right? If you start setting up the administrative bodies in villages and districts and sub-districts, even if you were doing so with local Cambodians, it would be easy to make the case to say, well, who and what is that being set up for? Where does the CPK's apparatus fit into that, etc., etc.? And the same goes for this other facet of this idea that they were setting up an army as well. And Pol bases that on, you know, those 5,000 rifles that he was promised by Lê Duẩn. Well, he says they never received a single one, and that the Vietnamese instead armed, quote, adventurers, bandits, delinquents, former soldiers or policemen dismissed by Lon Nol's regime, end quote. He goes on to say that this was mostly achieved in the East Zone, where soldiers were Cambodian, but the cadre were Vietnamese. On top of this, Pol claims that a military training school was also secretly opened by the Vietnamese during this time, again, in the East Zone. So what was the real intent behind these activities? Well, let's remain ambiguous on what we want to, you know, concede to Pol Pot's paranoia and, you know, revisionist history, and how much was actually pursued with, let's say, some percentage of future planning by the Vietnamese communists operating in Cambodia. Not to mention the immediate circumstances they were trying to take advantage of in the fallout from the coup. But whatever mixture of intent and reality and whatever might have been behind all of this, the fact of the matter is that the leader of the CPK is facing a very rapidly changing situation by the time he does get back to Cambodia. So let's follow him as he takes off from Hanoi on foot down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, the same way they had come up at the end of 1969. I think in those meetings, he would have at least felt confident that the tide had shifted significantly towards his aims. And as we mentioned, I think in the coup episode itself, he now has a huge amount of military and financial backing in the shape of the Vietnamese communists and China, as well as about the most influential and useful figurehead for the movement he could have asked for in the shape of Sihanouk. Saar, his wife, a few bodyguards, they travel down, and it takes like 10 weeks. They are the kind of first ones back, but they're followed down by groups of these returnees, the Hanoi-trained Cambodians, who at points are diverted into areas in Laos and filtered down into different regions of the country that had already been liberated by the Vietnamese. It should be mentioned that, well, we are talking about this journey occurring at around early to mid-April, so they're getting back late June and into July, so a significant amount of that journey is occurring during the American incursion and was, needless to say, quite a dangerous time. It was not uncommon for some of these returnees to not make it. I've seen some estimates in the sources here to say up to a third of them didn't make it from, you know, disease and bombing. But Salat Saar, needless to say, he does make it back. Arriving at a jungle encampment in Ratanakere in June, they make their way to the old headquarters and stay there for 2 months organizing duties and what was going to happen next. The plan was to move to a new headquarters in Kampong Tom province, in close proximity to the Chinit River. This wasn't too far away from the leader of the Northern Zone's base. His name was Khoi Thun, and he was a Central Committee member. That is the second highest leadership body in the CPK. Outside of the so-called Standing Committee, which is the top guys, including Pol and Nguyen Chea, etc. Khoi Thun had also been announced as the Vice Minister of the Economy for the shadow coalition government that we talked about, the GRUNC. I'm highlighting him because his name will come up again quite a bit later, but back to SAR. So they're moving to this new headquarters, right? Now, the location alone is pretty telling, right? Just a few months after the coup, things have advanced so quickly that the headquarters of the CPK can now safely be relocated away from, you know, the hills and jungles of the furthest away reaches of the country to the plains of Kampong Tom in central Cambodia, east of the Tonle Sap, the Great Lake. This is like moving your base from, I don't know, Alaska to West Virginia. Is that a reasonable comparison, American listeners? I'm sure there is a lot of nuance there that I'm not aware of, but the point I'm trying to make is that they're much more confidently existing in Cambodia now, in a more central location, closer to where the seat of power is in the country, and are far more, you know, capable of communicating now. You know, previously, if Pol Pot wanted to get a message out, you're relying on messengers making dangerous months-long journeys to and from this farthest away point of the country to just about everywhere else. Naturally, that lends itself to a higher degree of centralized control over the functions of the lower rungs of the party leadership and these zones that the party had divided the administration into. And it is along the lines of this new shift that SAR announces a kind of personal change to reflect the new stage that his revolution was heading into. On the eve of descending from the mountains into the lowlands, an event with symbolic resonance in Khmer culture, kind of like a man emerging from a rite of passage up in the jungles and now returning imbued with wisdom, he's more potent. But now, how much this was being consciously tapped into is hard to say, much like a lot of the background Buddhist themes that seem to find echoes in Khmer Rouge propaganda and policy, but anyway, SAR makes this notable announcement. According to Philip Short, SAR declared, "Now we're going down to the plains. Today, we will all change our names. I will no longer be Palk. From now on, I will call myself Pol." End quote. He also gave new names to his closest followers. Later, he'd extend this name he'd given himself to Pol Pot, following a custom of adding an extra syllable. Like, another example of this is how another member, Vaughn, became Vaughn Vet. Short goes on to say that no one actually knows why he chose the name Pol Pot, nor if it actually has a meaning behind that name. He does offer a couple of his own theories, though. It could be a reference to an ancient group of slaves to the royal family during the Angkorian period, the Pols. This might have been SAR's reference to his new relationship to Sihanouk, who was nominal head of the National Front, like he was a slave to the king again. This might have also been linked to the pseudonym he wrote under while studying in Paris when he attacked Sihanouk's policies. Back then, he had chose the name Khmer Daeom, meaning original Khmer, to write under, which, ironically, wasn't very original. In Penny Edwards' fantastic book on the French period in Cambodia, Cambodge, she talks about the variations on this kind of naming convention that had sprung up in the editorial pages of the nationalist newspaper Nagaravata in the 30s. And Khmer Daeom was a fairly regular one from what I gather. You know, you write in under a name that also gets your point across and conceals your identity. Another one that was commonly used in the editorial pages was Son of the Khmers or Khmer Hereditary Slave. Think about someone writing in, giving their two cents on current affairs and not having to worry too much about getting a knock on the door from the police. Perhaps not much has changed today, with the equivalent thing on social media being a politically resonant screen name and a little picture of some kind of flag or whatever being the move for some people to get their point across in the modern version of the editorial pages. Anyway, moving on, I can now call SAR Pol Pot, which will be easier, and it's been on my mind because I knew this part of Short's book establishes this happening in 1970, but there were other sources that also mentioned he'd started using the name Pol earlier, so I'd always been a little bit, you know, can I just call him Pol Pot already? And now, confidently, after this point, Salot Sar is Pol Pot. Short exemplifies his mastery of the English language by stating that on the journey from Ratanakere to Kampong Tom, a slow journey punctuated by the occasional American bombing, when the transmogrified Pol Pot, great word, had to look that one up, means magically or surprisingly transformed, they arrived to their destination toward the end of September. So it's been almost 6 months since he left Hanoi. A lot has gone on. He's now going to establish himself in this central location and clear up exactly what the Communist Party of Kampuchea was going to be from this point forward. Okay, so Pol Pot has arrived in Kampong Tom, where he's set up his new headquarters. Just a few huts for himself, Noan Chea, and a few others, at a place they named K5. He's got plenty of organising to do, so he convenes a meeting of his top leaders who were available. This was an important meeting, especially given the state the CPK found itself in toward the end of 1970. You could say it was yet another fork in the road. This time, they picked a very specific direction. What this meeting established, and given the context this move makes sense, was the idea, or rather the principle, of independence mastery. This concept of independence mastery was central to the, what would the businessy modern politics way of saying this today be like, you know, their core values, their aims, and their ideology. The first slide of that PowerPoint presentation at the business meeting where they posed the question, who are we and what do we want? You know, Apple is what think differently. Disneyland is the happiest place on earth. And while the Cambodian communists are going to have different slogans that they will end up being associated with, more think revolution and the place of nightmares on earth, well, independence mastery will be the eventual answer to any question about what the Khmer Rouge were trying to do, with other ideological influences and policies all flowing into this fundamental aim. So what did it mean? Well, simply put, it's the idea that Cambodia should be self-reliant, free of foreign control, and capable of thriving on its own means of production. This wasn't about uniting humanity in a grand class struggle. Rather, it was very much Cambodia first. But this wasn't just a plan for autarky, a state or society that's economically independent. It has all these echoes of the awkwardness of Cambodian relations with the Thai and Vietnamese since, like, the 1700s, and of course then colonialism and this new Cold War era. So, you know, the whole hurricane of history dynamic is really at play in this Khmer Rouge value, a plan for greatness, a return to greatness, not needing help, showing other countries just how awesome the Khmer race is and how well they were going to do communism. And that is kind of where we begin knocking at the door of a much larger discussion about what role does communism really play for the Khmer Rouge? Was it just window dressing? Branding? Was communism being co-opted for a specific cause, used with an eye on, say, Mao's China, as the best means to achieve independence from imperialism? Of course, they have this example with the Vietnamese as well. Or was it a particularly great solution to the realities of an undeveloped economy in a country with a huge number of rural peasants? How much was there a real belief in communism? Or how much was it, like, serving a specific function and the answer to a national question, rather than the underlying grandiose so-called scientific Marxist theory of history and class struggle and all of that? This is a discussion perhaps we'll return to in another episode. For now, what matters is that this meeting locked in independence mastery as a guiding principle. According to Philip Short, the phrase itself seems to have roots in Pali, the language of the Buddhist monks, and it proclaimed the overriding importance of determining their own strategy, free from outside influence. And with a choice of words that deliver an unsubtle glare at an elephant in the room in the shape of the Vietnamese communists. Short includes a revealing excerpt from the meeting's deliberations in his book. Quote, "The Cambodian party has traced its own revolutionary path. We must not permit other powerful states to decide the destiny of our nation, our people, and our revolution. At present, these states still nurture this ancient longing. In the past, we held our destiny firmly in our own hands, and then we allowed others to resolve it in our place. We must never allow this historical error to be repeated. Aid from abroad, even if healthy and unconditional, can never play a decisive role, either in the short term or the long term. We must always hold firmly to the stance of independence mastery, rely on our own forces, and endure difficulties and suffering. On that basis, whether we accept or do not accept aid will depend on whether or not we think it is necessary, on whether we find it useful or harmful, and also on the manner in which that aid is to be used." End quote. So the message is loud and clear, right? Hey guys, we need to remember this is our thing. Don't let anyone else try and take it away from us, whoever that might be. And remember that it may or may not have been those same unnamed persons who left us high and dry 15 years ago at Geneva. Very subtle. There's no way anyone could deduce that he was talking about the Vietnamese. There's an underlying warning here. Don't be lured by the promise of help, because there are always strings attached. Think of the 200 hospital beds, the well-trained cadre, the guns and ammunition. Yes, we're going to take what we need, but we cannot fall into a larger trap. Pol Pot's return into this somewhat chaotic scene led to his considerations as the leader to lay down his management of this, to make sure everyone knew the CPK were in control, that they had got very far without the Vietnamese, and they will need to make sure they can continue to struggle without them. He emphasized independence mastery almost as if it was a moral imperative, like warning people not to take shortcuts, don't take the quick cash, do the things the long and hard way if necessary. And this was all wrapped up in typical Cambodian nationalist rhetoric with this dominant threat from Vietnam who, as he characterizes it, want to control Cambodian land and have done for hundreds of years. With Pol Pot back and this meeting concluded, we see exactly where his worries lay and how he planned to tackle them, while still winning the war. As Philip Short notes, at this point, it was mostly theoretical. Pol Pot knew his party wasn't ready to take the reins on its own and would still need a lot of help from the Vietnamese. But the political line, independence mastery, was set. From here on, Pol would be watching carefully to see who followed it. This same meeting also decided to send Yeng Sari to Hanoi and Beijing as a representative, mainly to keep tabs on Sihanouk and handle external relations. Yeng Sari, one of Pol's closest allies, would stay close to Sihanouk throughout the civil war, becoming the public face of the regime internationally while keeping the real power structure safely hidden away. Alright, so that meeting took place in September. We now have this idea of independence mastery, essentially announcing that Pol Pot is back in the country and operating from a more central position. He's aware of everything that's happened in the 6 months since the coup and is working on ways to keep the CPK's primacy from being undermined by the Vietnamese, all while ensuring that as much territory and manpower as possible fall under Khmer Rouge control. By late 1970, the Khmer Rouge probably had up to 15,000 Cambodians armed against the government, split into 20 purely Cambodian battalions and 5 mixed Khmer-Vietnamese battalions. That's perhaps triple what they had before the coup, and they were much better armed now. On top of the roughly 10,000 Khmer Rouge fighters, there were several times that number of Viet Cong and North Vietnamese troops operating nearby, and over 1 million Cambodian civilians likely living under these so-called liberated areas. The Vietnamese still handled most of the actual military engagements, of course, but whenever territory fell or battles were won, the communist propaganda gave all the credit to the Khmer Rouge. That served a twofold purpose. One, it kept up the appearance that the Vietnamese were not simply invading Cambodia, and two, it maintained a show of solidarity. No one wanted to publicly undercut their Khmer allies. Behind the scenes, however, tensions were bubbling up. Some incidents were relatively small, like telling the Khmer returnees from Hanoi that they now had to join the Communist Party of Kampuchea instead of the Vietnamese Workers' Party or the old Khmer People's Revolutionary Party, which they told them had been, you know, was no longer a thing. Others were more serious. According to a CIA report cited in Kiernan's How Pol Pot Came to Power, there was an episode where Khmer Rouge troops opened fire on Vietnamese forces during an assault on a provincial capital, prompting the Vietnamese to issue a directive that no one, you know, retaliate to that. In Takeo Province, a local Khmer Rouge cadre described what Pol Pot referred to as a parallel state power. Vietnamese troops had liberated an area, then organized the village administration in a so-called mixed Khmer-Viet Cong system. But in practice, everything answered to a Viet Cong official. It was basically a colonial setup, Khmer officials in name, but all under Vietnamese oversight. Kiernan offers another example, in a different province, of that same dynamic. The Vietnamese had come in, conducted local elections, declared loyalty to Sihanouk, and even handed out little pro-Sihanouk badges to new officials. But when the Khmer Rouge eventually arrived, they executed those Sihanoukist officials who'd essentially been installed by the Vietnamese. It's interesting to place that in the context of what Pol Pot later wrote about this same period in his Black Book. There he claims that once his zone leaders, cadres, and he himself started rebuffing further help, which they saw as undermining them, the Vietnamese responded by sending a delegation to discuss what they called the problem of solidarity and cooperation. He says these talks took place in November 1970 with Nguyen Van Linh and Tran Nam Trung on the Stung Chinit River in Kampong Tom. So this is about 30 to 40 kilometres sort of equidistant between Pol Pot's headquarters and the Vietnamese Khos Van base in Cambodia. Now, these talks would actually serve to clear up a lot of issues that were occurring once they were over. However, Pol Pot's description of these talks in the Black Book contains some stunning revelations, according to him at least. He describes these talks as focusing on the same issues that Vietnamese kept pushing: mixed organs of state power, military and technical schools, and essentially the same demands that Le Duan had made to Pol Pot back in Hanoi. Pol characterizes the Khmer Rouge side of the negotiations as follows. Quote, "The CPK agreed to their demands, but asked them not to carry out any undermining activities among the people and the Revolutionary Army of Kampuchea. We politely let them know we were totally self-sufficient, with ample weaponry, and that each zone had several battalions of troops. The negotiations lasted a week. During that time, a member of the Vietnamese delegation skipped two meals, saying he'd eaten enough fruit. He also slept less. In fact, he was thinking deeply. This was his turning point, the moment he decided he ought to eliminate the leaders of the Communist Party of Kampuchea. After those negotiations, we became aware of that intent, but our analysis was incomplete. In truth, the Vietnamese had decided to eliminate our leadership ever since we rebuffed joint commands back in April." End quote. Okay, that's quite the claim, and he further explains it. Quote, "At the talks in November 1970, the Vietnamese tried to have Comrade Secretary Pol Pot and Comrade Deputy Nguyen Chea poisoned by their own agents, who had infiltrated the CPK." End quote. He then lays out how this supposedly happened. Quote, "The talks were held in the North Zone, where the Zone Secretary of Khoi Tun oversaw the proceedings. His wife was doing the cooking. When he was arrested in 1976, Khoi Tun revealed that he'd been ordered to carry out this odious task, having received poison from one of the Vietnamese delegates, an agent sent to sabotage the Cambodian Revolution. Fortunately, our party had strict vigilance measures and had loyal comrades working in the kitchen, so this heinous Vietnamese crime failed. End quote. This is what makes the Livre Noir, the Black Book, such a fascinating source. It's full of these wild accusations and bits of insight, but most of it is either deliberate fabrication or just one side of the story. Maybe there's a fraction of truth in there, but it raises a bigger question. Why did Pol Pot believe this? And how did truth even function under a regime where reality was routinely moulded to fit paranoid narratives? I realise we're sort of going back and forth in time here, but it's very interesting to think about. Like, this was a book that was published to sort of make the Cambodian case that they were being, you know, invaded and trying to show just how bad the Vietnamese were. Why publish such specific claims about the Vietnamese trying to poison Pol Pot and Nguyen Chea, complete with details like the visiting delegate skipping a couple of meals because he'd eaten fruit? It's a strange thing to be so specific and so sincere, I suppose, about that, when it reads like a complete fabrication. Pol Pot claims they learned about it in 1976 from Khoi Thun. This was after he had been arrested by the CPK, but up until that point, he had remained the head of the Northern Zone. This was published because, I suppose, as wild as this story might seem, it really was believed by Pol Pot. Like I said, it was this very sincere thing to put in this book. Even more telling are the footnotes that Pol Pot includes. Next to Khoi Thun's name, he writes that he was a CIA agent since 1958, who infiltrated the CPK in 1960. Then there's Men San, said to be the one who took the poison from the Vietnamese to give to Khoi Thun. Pol claims that Men San was kidnapped by the Vietnamese in 1946, took the name Ne Saran, and was abandoned by them after Geneva, only to become a CIA agent in 1955, then reactivated by the Viet Cong. So he's now a double agent for both Vietnam, the Vietnamese communists, I should say, and the CIA. He was more high-ranking in the CIA than Khoi Thun, so he ordered him to carry out the plot, like I'm reading from the footnotes here. Ne Saran was another leading member of the party for a long time. He had also been arrested and no doubt had included his own narratives along these lines, which Pol doesn't mention for obvious reasons, had been extracted at S21. Reading these footnotes in the Black Book can leave you a little dumbfounded. And the sad reality of it, when you look past the matter-of-fact information that Pol Pot had included, and what we now know about what had happened, was that Khoi Thun had been arrested in 1976, sent to S21 in January of 1977, and he was executed in March. Probably one of the most well-known photos that still exists of Khoi Thun is on display in the Tuol Sleng Genocide Museum today, amongst headshots of thousands of others. His photo includes more. It's sort of taken a bit further back. He's sitting on a bed frame, shackled to it. He has a look on his face that's hard to describe. Compared to the few other photos that I've seen of him as a revolutionary, he had a fuller face back then. He seemed strong, like he could be a rugby player or something. Here, in the photo of him imprisoned, you can almost see how much his body and soul were defeated. He wasn't gaunt, but he seemed to be physically manifesting the resignation to his fate that he would have full well known as soon as he was arrested. He knew what the party was, how they operated. And when you hear the details of this obviously concocted story about poison during this meeting, well, when you think about the brutal torture that needed to be inflicted on someone for long enough that they would have gone from, "I don't know what you guys are talking about, I'm a loyal party member," to later, "Yeah, this specific person who was a spy for the CIA told me to do it, and also I'm in the CIA and have been since this specific date, and my wife was working in the kitchen on the meals, but we weren't able to succeed, and also I was doing it for the Vietnamese." if you think from going of, you know, from that baseline of genuinely innocent denial to hammering out the details of a decade-long plot which culminated in this attempted assassination, well, that kind of revelation took a long time and a lot of extraction. It had to be created through torture. Khoi Tun had been a teacher. He had graduated from the prestigious Lycée Sisawat. He had been co-opted by the party operating in the schools and sponsored to become a member by Son Sen. He fled to the Marquis in the mid-1960s. This had been one of the most trusted members of the party. In 1971, he will be appointed to the Central Committee. But in 1976, he was in S21, tortured for weeks, producing hundreds of names and detailed narratives of his own and other people's treasonous behaviour. David Chandler, in Voices from S21, explains that Khoi Tun's eventual confession reads like a mirror image of the party's triumphal narrative. Every supposed plan, you know, assassinate Pol Pot, gather forces, form rival parties, secure Thai, American, Vietnamese support, these all went nowhere. The regime remained invincible and clairvoyant, while Khoi Tun's alleged treachery just highlighted the party's strength. It becomes clear how confident and self-assured the Khmer Rouge wanted to appear, never admitting any mistakes. Meanwhile, they were utterly paranoid that all they'd built could vanish if they let their guard down for even a second. A lethal combination. Anyway, I just wanted to jump ahead briefly to show how many of the features of Democratic Kampuchea, the ones we'll see later, already had their foundations laid in this period. For instance, something as small as a Vietnamese representative skipping a couple of meals, supposedly because he'd filled up on fruit, could be highlighted as crucial evidence and then woven into these coerced confessions that Pol Pot and Nguyen Chea were marked for assassination. So this is something, you know, remember that time 6 years ago where that guy didn't eat? I think that was something, you know? Let's circle that in red. And if you expand that logic beyond someone like Khoi Tun to include the Hanoi returnees or really anyone else installed by the Vietnamese in these liberated areas or anyone even under working, you know, for a commanding officer who had been installed like that or who had ties to the Vietnamese or who was seen as tainted, well, you can guess what happened. Labelled spies or saboteurs, and tens of thousands weren't going to escape that fate in massive purges. And just to be clear, when I say confessions that are being made at S21, I'm using scare quotes, you know what I mean? It's not a confession. It is a narrative that was beaten, prompted, pulled, humiliated, carved, and broken out of someone who could only think of what to say to stop the fear and pain, even if that meant naming anyone they could think of, including their families. And there is this added wrinkle to that whole scenario where, like I said, Khoi Tun, he was a top Khmer Rouge leader, the guy who oversaw the ministry for wiping out enemies that was hastily set up on the same day that Phnom Penh's population was told to leave the city in 1975, where he will be in charge of organizing the execution of the Lon Nol government members who had stayed in the country, and often their families. In fact, most of the people who were sent through the gates of S21 were Khmer Rouge. It was the most important prison in the country. Where do you send your most important prisoners to extract the most important information that you can? Okay, So, by the end of 1970, despite the fact that Pol Pot would later conclude the meeting with the Vietnamese was really an assassination attempt, it did resolve some of the immediate issues that had been bubbling up. The two sides agreed that the Vietnamese would withdraw their civilian cadres from liberated areas as soon as Khmer Rouge personnel could replace them. They also agreed to expand military training programs, allowing the Khmer Rouge to conduct more of the fighting, as well as transitioning mixed battalions into purely Khmer units. Philip Short writes, quote, "After this meeting, friction between the two sides, which had led to armed clashes in the autumn of 1970, markedly declined." End quote. We have to see this in light of Pol Pot's broader objectives. He wanted to strengthen the Khmer Rouge militarily so they could eventually wage war against Lon Nol on their own, particularly once the US and North Vietnam wrapped up peace negotiations in Paris. It was a balancing act. Squeeze as much support as possible from the Vietnamese while ensuring they don't stick around or undermine the CPK's power. This meant that the Communist Party of Kampuchea needed firm control over the recruits joining the cause, both in the armed forces and in the party itself. It was during this period that the CPK began focusing even more on rural peasants and farmers as the bedrock of the revolution. Admission to the party was closed to people from middle-class backgrounds. The leadership believed only poor peasants had the necessary class origins to be trusted. Meanwhile, anyone, regardless of background, could still join the Khmer Rouge army, but the party itself grew more exclusive. In Tragedy of Cambodian History, David Chandler highlights a surviving document from this era titled Strategy of Rural Policy of the Party. It proclaims, "Farmers are a source of endless strength. They can produce manpower and material power. The revolution of our country cannot proceed without their strength." The text goes on to claim that under imperialists, feudalists, and reactionary capitalists, farmers were denied basic rights like voting, reading progressive literature, or even travelling freely to earn a living. Rights which, as Chandler rightly notes, the Khmer Rouge certainly didn't go on to provide once they did gain power. He also cites a pamphlet for cadres that emphasized revolutionary will over theory or practical expertise. Kind of like saying, oh, you don't need fancy book learning to be a revolutionary. You just need the right attitude. In the Cambodian context, drawing on the Theravada Buddhist idea of Satyarama, revolutionary consciousness, which we've spoken about before, it meant focusing on mental discipline and ideological commitment above all else. We also have notes from an end of 1970 political training session, which Chandler believes foreshadowed the Khmer Rouge policies to come. He describes their language as ambiguous yet menacing, mirroring Pol Pot's later speeches during Democratic Kampuchea. A standout line reads, "The immediate purpose of our movement is to destroy everything which is instrumental in suppressing our people." Another pamphlet Chandler quotes offers a Khmer Rouge definition of class as the level of people with distinctive political tendencies. Now that might sound like typical Marxist jargon, but if we distill it, it's basically saying a person's class is tied to their political identity and behavior. And combine that with the usual labels of good or bad classes in Marxist rhetoric, and a stark binary emerges. You're either one class or another, which meant you are either an enemy or friend, a revolutionary or a counter-revolutionary. Many genocide scholars note this sort of binary is a crucial step in mass killings. In Cambodia, under the Khmer Rouge, society was similarly carved into new people and base people, defined by whether you'd lived in Khmer Rouge-controlled zones pre-1975, or if you were one of the city dwellers expelled after their victory in April. That's a textbook binary. And as we'll see, it was a major psychological step toward genocide, though in this case it was driven less by race or religion, following, you know, the actual genocide definition, than by a political in-group versus out-group mindset, crafted in the CPK's imagination and enforced by their cadres. All right, I realize we're getting off into the weeds again there, but I don't need to jump ahead quite as much like I used to because these things are just around the corner. We're going to have plenty of time to dig into these policies when we reach them. So let's wrap up where the Khmer Rouge stood by the end of 1970, going into early 1971. Pol Pot has been working to make good on all the propaganda about how they were the ones doing all the fighting, not the Vietnamese. He wants their liberated zones under Khmer Rouge control, reflecting this grand idea of independence mastery, essentially trying to live up to their own marketing. And we haven't talked much about Sihanouk in this episode, and that's fine. At this point, he's settled comfortably in Beijing, treated like a prince, and he's being coddled enough to think everything's going well and that he's still very important. Meanwhile, by late 1970, Pol Pot has hashed out an agreement with the Vietnamese that mostly suits him, though plenty of challenges still lie ahead. I think I remember making this point a few episodes back. Once they had set up their own office, Office 100 in Ratanakiri for the first time. They had their base away from the Vietnamese, and it was almost like, you know, that first share house when you move out when you're a teenager in your early 20s and you pull in a couch that you find on the side of the road and you are like, yes, we are cooking with gas. Well, at this point, the CPK had, what would the equivalent leveling up be? Maybe they've organized enough to go to IKEA or something, and they're getting their first shelves and a dining table or something. It's a step up for them. They've got this new base in Kampong Tom, S71, which was larger than the old one, K5, on the Chinit River. This newer HQ has 20 to 30 thatched houses, guard rooms, a messenger office, and even a printing shop. The old base is now a support hub, and together they form a small region that the leadership will use to coordinate the entire movement. That smaller outpost, S31, housed about 200 people, including a 60-person troupe of musicians and dancers who roamed the northern zone giving performances designed to inspire both local villagers and Khmer Rouge cadre. They also created an information office where most of the party's lower-ranking intellectuals, what Sihanouk would have called the Khmer Rouges, were stationed, while another office was set up to increase production of the party's magazine, Revolutionary Flags. Philip Short shares an interesting anecdote from a cadre named Ping Sai, who worked at both the smaller outpost, S31, and the main command base, S71. He recalls the oppressive security measures designed to protect the top leadership, Pol Pot and Nguyen Chea and the others, who were kept off-limits from almost everyone else. Even a zone leader visiting the base had to leave bodyguards and weapons behind, then be escorted in. I'll share the quote from Ping Sai. Quote, "The base was in a part of the jungle reserved exclusively for the leaders. No one was allowed to enter without an escort, usually a Montagnard tribesman. Once inside, you were confined to your assigned area. If you tried to move around, someone would stop you. What are you doing? Why are you going from place to place? The huts had thatched roofs and walls with a hard bed of woven bamboo, plus a bamboo desk and chair, very simple and rustic. They were spaced 20 or 30 yards apart, sometimes 50, separated by thick hedges so you couldn't see from one to another. Back then, I didn't even know where Pol Pot's office was. Everything was kept strictly separate. The offices were only a mile or two apart, but each was in its own zone. In Pol Pot's office, conditions were similar to ours, but let me tell you a story. When I arrived, I said to someone, 'Ah, I see you always build your camp by a watercourse.' Pol Pot's office, like S31, was on a stream bank. That remark was reported back, and two or three days later, Yun Yat, Son Sen's wife, called me in and said I shouldn't speak like that. I had to show revolutionary vigilance. On one level, she had a point. If the enemy learned that detail, it might be a clue to the headquarters location. But the way she scolded me made me realize how intense their revolutionary vigilance was. They were extremely secretive, even among themselves." End quote. But as Philip Short describes it, Pol Pot and Nguyen Chea shared a kind of collective neurosis. He argues that their totalitarianism and obsession with secrecy partly sprang from a belief that Cambodians in general couldn't keep secrets, which widens out to some stereotypes of Cambodians as lazy and needing to be compelled to be able to follow this revolutionary worldview. Meaning, a society would need to be developed which mitigated any of these supposedly negative traits. Short writes, quote, "It was this perception that the intrinsic flaws of the Cambodian people could only be overcome by absolute discipline and secrecy, enforced ruthlessly at every level, that laid the groundwork for the totalitarian regime the Khmer Rouge would later impose." End quote. And that kind of relates to what we were talking about before, right? This contradiction between this belief in essentially the racial superiority of the Khmer, of their greatness, and therefore how amazing their revolution was going to be, but also this insecurity that seemed to be baked into the need for this revolutionary vanguard, the Communist Party of Kampuchea, to pull the entire country into the utopian dream they had, by whatever measures they needed to use. The results of which meant that they had to fiercely indoctrinate members of the party and the army, and soon whole populations that were under their control, which, midway through 1971, was probably close to 3 million Cambodians. And so we see this almost monastic discipline within the party, something uniquely Cambodian, woven into a communist framework that had borrowed a mishmash of elements from elsewhere. For instance, the naming conventions for all these places, K5, S31, S71, M100, that was a Vietnamese system, passed on to the Khmer Rouge by their mentors. Another example is the whole notion of brother number one or brother number two, which apparently came from Ho Chi Minh's practice of choosing aliases for his Politburo members decades earlier. It was rooted in the Vietnamese family model, which had siblings referred to by birth order. According to Philip Short, when Salot Sar visited Hanoi in 1965, the Vietnamese addressed him as An Hai, first brother, signifying him as the eldest of the Cambodian revolutionary family. The Khmers adopted this system, calling Sar Bang Ti Moi, brother number one, and Nuon Chea as brother number two. Short also points out that the Orwellian ring of brother number one, like Big Brother in 1984, comes mostly from its English translation and understanding. In Khmer, it sounds commonplace and even reassuring, more like a typical family nickname in East Asia than an ominous authoritarian title. Okay, anyway, as we move into 1971, Lon Nol's government is basically secure only in the towns and their immediate outskirts, as well as Phnom Penh. Bombing has intensified since July 1970 because the incursion from the Americans and the South Vietnamese didn't destroy Cosvin, as we saw in the last episode, as the Americans had hoped. And now the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese army are pretty much everywhere in the Cambodian countryside. When Lon Nol realized he wouldn't be getting the kind of on-the-ground US support the South Vietnamese had got, he essentially broke down crying in front of Alexander Haig, Nixon's chief of staff, who was visiting the country. But still, the Americans could bomb, and Lon Nol went along with that strategy. We'll dive deeper into this in the next episode, but they also tried a major offensive against the communists now that their army had ballooned from, 30,000 when the war began to 150,000. This was called Chen La One, named after the ancient pre-Angkorian state. Again, we'll discuss this more in the next episode. But for now, just note that the Khmer Rouge kept growing stronger, but they had to bide their time. This leads us to a series of CPK meetings, or party congresses, which brought the entire organisation together to map out a strategy. At one such gathering, they announced a new central committee, doubling its size from before. They hadn't all met together since 1966, by the way. Notably, none of the Hanoi returnees were admitted, reaffirming that no matter how well-trained these people were, the party didn't trust them. They also officially renamed themselves the Communist Party of Kampuchea, a name secretly adopted back in 1967 but never publicly used. Outside the party, they would remain known simply as ANKAR, the organization, and the Standing Committee at the top also expanded, so it included Pol Pot, Nguyen Che, of course, as well as Sao Pim, Yang Sari, Vaughn Vet, Tha Mok, and Son Sen. Cadres back in the respective zones across the country were given a number of booklets that were produced at the Congress, and these set out resolutions on the economy, production cooperatives, elimination of exploitation, markets, things about culture, social action, military campaigning, and party statutes. Again, imagine this, in a big business conference context, and you've got PowerPoints about the fall quarter and new techniques for sales, and we're going to use a new operating system on the computers and a new email system, a new way to reach more customers. I kind of see it like that. It's really setting an agenda. However, what this really amounted to was the conduct of how the revolution was going to be carried out, and it even laid out the collectivization of land, moving people out of the towns, and expelling Vietnamese troops. So we are getting what was essentially the plan for democratic Kampuchea that will be installed across the nation in 1975. Interestingly, in how Pol Pot came to power, Ben Kiernan suggests some members, some of the intellectuals like Hu Nim and Hu Yuan, along with Eastern's own leader Sao Pim, actually pushed back on some of these extreme ideas. They preferred what was called mutual aid teams, a Maoist concept where smaller groups of farmers pooled labour and resources rather than having giant collectives run by the state. They also questioned, you know, getting rid of markets entirely. Of course, pushing back might have been noted, but the general sentiment at the Congress was that things were going well, so why not just trust the leadership that had got them this far? Still, some of these dissenters' doubts would definitely be remembered and come back to haunt them. By the middle of 1971, things were going very well for the Khmer Rouge. In fact, you could argue that the political war was already lost by Lon Nol. The countryside was largely out of the hands of the government, and while the Vietnamese had liberated all that territory, the process was now underway to hand it over to the Khmer Rouge. They were indoctrinating the local population and preparing to institute some of the revolutionary plans that would develop into these aims that were laid out in the 1971 Party Congress. Cadre were urged to speak in a friendly manner, to show them what a good revolutionary was, and to distinguish themselves from the Lon Nol regime and their soldiers who were being portrayed as imperialist lackeys of the US, whose bombs were destroying their livelihoods and killing their family members. It was also a time when these binaries between friend and foe, revolutionary and counter-revolutionary, became more defined. One of the cadres who was involved in fighting the war explained what this meant for the realities of fighting the war. Quote, "Our side had orders never to be taken alive by the enemy, and we treated them the same. We didn't take prisoners. It was a merciless struggle. We need to draw a clear line between ourselves and the enemy." And it was that guiding principle, no prisoners, no mercy, spies everywhere, which ultimately leads us to the place where we opened this episode, the creation of M13 in southwest Cambodia, under the direction of Doik, where he would perfect his torture techniques, learn how to extract this information, and many people would be killed at M13 in much the same way that they did in S21 when the regime was in full power. We'll see that next time. Thank you so much for listening. This is Lachlan Peters, and In the Shadows of Utopia. Goodbye.